This is tape 2 of a reading by Goblin Hood of an unpublished story, essay, something by James Beatty called Steel Bob and Monstrella. This reading takes place during the final, or this tape starts only a small part of the way into part 4 of the document, so there's only actually a couple of pages left. Anyway, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. Things started out pretty copacetic. In the studio, the newly started, long-awaited, sweet Sodom Apocalypso triptych was finally underway. It sat there with its vulgar face hanging out, like an aroused mongrel dog wagging its tail almost obscenely. Its form was that of 3 30-by-40-inch stretched canvases, easily stacked and hidden, covered at this point with Martian underdrawing in the form of lurid colored pencil sketches, incredibly convoluted and intertwined, but still recognizably vile, odious, and, what the hell, even monstrous. But I was in the living room, probably scribbling away at notes and preliminary sketches for the painting, or at some weird document not unlike this one. Whatever else I was doing, I was fairly chuckling with exuberant glee at finally starting to realize this vast and important project. But then a surprise visitor showed up. It was a casual friend named Monstrella. She'd never visited me before. I wasn't even aware that she knew where I lived. But the purpose of her seemingly casual visit soon became clear. She was clearly out to get laid. I'd never thought of Monstrella in sexual terms before, though I'd always found her attractive. But now she came off as wholly, burningly desirable and willing. She began, in fact, unmistakably coming on to me. One thing, though, hadn't changed in this dream apartment. My slovenly bedroom was still a cross between a wild animal's den and an auto-erotic torture chamber. The floor beside my scruffy mattress, strewn with scorching anal erotic pornography and assorted sex toy paraphernalia. I couldn't let her see that. I had to keep her away from there at all costs, or she'd be likely to change her mind on the spot. And even asleep, I could remember how long it had been since I'd even gotten to dream about this stuff. I didn't want to blow it now. She mustn't see the bedroom, I thought desperately, and then, with sheer horror, I remembered the exposed triptych. If she sees that, my mind gibbered, it's all over. She'll know everything sleazy there is to know about me. As I mentioned, the important triptych drawing was already pretty, well, you know the drill by now. Oddly, I didn't see the potential convenience of that self-revelation, how much red tape it could cut through as it were. I guess I wanted her to learn about my proclivities more diplomatically or something. At any rate, I was terrified of scaring her off. So there was no time to be lost. I'd worry about the bedroom later. The triptych, remote as it was, seemed the greater emergency. And so, with admirably suave and debonair subtlety, I suddenly made this mad dash into the studio to begin frantically and feverishly stacking the triptych panels face to against the wall in the secret chamber. And just in time, Monstrella was right on my heels, still radiating an unequivocal aura of sexual invitation, but also complaining loudly about the low rent mess that even my living room was in. Definitely keep her away from the bedroom, I thought determinedly, wondering if I could talk her into doing it on the studio's floor. And would it have been worth it after all? I wonder that now. Even if I could have fucked her up the ass, would it have been worth all her pissing and moaning about what a slob I am? Would it have been worth having to hide all the porn to keep her from being jealous or whatever? Would it have been worth painting when she wasn't around so she'd never see how badly I was perverting my art from any normal point of view? Well, yeah. At least screwing her yummy butt would have seemed worth it at the time. There just isn't anything better under the sun. But I can't imagine what the rest of the relationship would have been like. It's hard to say just what would have happened next if Steel Bob hadn't interrupted us just then. Turns out Steel Bob was my butler or something. He must have hired on since Monstrella's arrival, though, because I distinctly remember not having had a butler before that. Now, however, we could hear Steel Bob ostentatiously answering the front door out in the living room. I went out there to see what was what and got my first look at Steel Bob. He was sort of a cowboy Jeeves. The steel was apparently as in steel guitar. In fact, Steel Bob was supposedly a part-time country and western music DJ, and my full-time butler too, of course. It's strange how much information one glimpse of something can convey in a dream. Oddly, his cheesy, glittery western duds reminded me obscurely of Howard Campbell Jr.'s Wild West Nazi uniform in Kurt Vonnegut's classic novels Mother Night and Slaughterhouse-Five, or maybe in the film version of the latter. But Steel Bob seemed mellower than that. He was more like Gene Autry dashing back and forth between his radio ranch and Murania, the hidden lost world featured in the old 1936 mascot serial, The Phantom Empire. Right now, in any case, Steel Bob was the very soul of deadpan butlerian decorum, politely holding the door open and coughing, discreetly but significantly, into his other fist. I noticed my new guests crowding in at the door. It was a surprise family visit from my elders. My parents were there, and various aunts and uncles, and more besides. And I don't know how to explain this, but even though these folks were from my past, this all seemed sort of futuristic. It reminded me of the way I felt when I first saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, back in 1969. I could almost hear the film's theme music in the background, from the Star Child sequence, perhaps. I felt on the brink of some vast cosmic revelation, but I couldn't spare the time for that now. Christ, Monstrella was still alone in the studio with that fucking triptych, maybe peeking at it for all I knew. Meanwhile, the eager faces of my new guests gradually began to register hurt bemusement. These poor chumps could all somehow intuit that I didn't exactly want them to be there. Not just now, of all times, anyway, but they couldn't quite imagine why that might be. For one thing, I observed privately, I've got enough problems and complications right through here. That tawdry bedroom situation again. And the last thing Monstrella and I need just now is an audience, particularly not this audience. Suddenly, my memory stopped failing me. And besides, my mind triumphantly bleated, many of these people have been dead for years by now. And I was wondering uneasily about the others when I woke up. The Rites of Necrosha by James Beatty, from the book Nightmares for the Yesterday People and Other Illustrated Stories, copyright 1981 by James Beatty, read by Goblin Hood. The Rites of Necrosha, in which the management cannot be held responsible for damages. I dreamed that I was living with my mother again, though my real mother has been dead these past 17 years or more. In my dream, we were living together in a little cottage deep within a huge dark forest. One morning, as my mother and I sat eating our breakfast, my friends Bryce and Stan, the somber brothers, showed up to invite me on a pilgrimage to the distant Isle of Orcus to observe the dread rites of Necrosha. For some reason, I had no choice but to accompany them, whether I wished to or not. And so I bade farewell to my beloved mother and set out with my companions on a long and peril-fraught journey to the shadow-haunted island and the fabled dream city of Necropolis. After many hair-raising exploits and adventures along the way, we arrived at the mystic citadel just in time to help celebrate the festival of the departed. This involved a week of feasting and general revelry, which, oddly, took place in the actual dormitory where I lived back in real life while attending the Ohio State University, a relatively gloomy and cheerless place called Morrill Tower. Finally, all the jollity and merriment of the festival had expended itself. The party was over, and now the true Necrosian rituals were about to begin. The day after the festival's end, Bryce and Stan Somber escorted me away from the dormitory along a lengthy, narrow causeway to a vast, towering edifice of stone, a mighty structure known only in legend as the Dread Tower of Necrosia. A thousand marble steps led up to its yawning, pillar-framed doorway. For some reason, the causeway and stairs were strewn and littered with coins and bills of high denomination. And as we proceeded, I kept stopping and stuffing my pockets with money. Inside the tower was a large and crowded room, which was strangely like a modern library or a railroad terminal on a busy day. It also had a rather clinical flavor. At the behest of the Brothers Somber, I approached two white-garbed technicians and told them my name and my errand. I'm here for the rites of Necrosia. Just a moment, said the male functionary. He consulted briefly with first his female partner, then a computerized filing system. They both then approached a wall containing a row of vast human-sized lockers, which at first I took to be some sort of cryogenic chambers. But when I handed the woman some of my found money, her partner began opening a locker with my own family name on it, and I saw the true nature of those grim receptacles, and also understood at last the true nature of the grim and gloomy rites of Necrosia. Within the locker, partly obscured by some sort of crude wooden latticework of questionable function, was an ancient wooden coffin, rotting and crumbling, and within that was a corpse. I somehow knew that the corpse was that of my mother, though its apparent identity was obscured by the revolting fact that it had been dead and decomposing for several years. As I gaped at the thing, horror-stricken and repulsed, almost to the point of violent nausea by the spectacle, I couldn't help noticing a ghastly yellowish cloud, a hazy aura drifting about the corpse's decayed skull like a nacreous halo, somehow reminding me sickeningly of chicken soup. The male attendant, sensing my distress, and seeming to read my thoughts, indicated the yellow haze and said, "We couldn't help that, you know. After the first decade, well, she'd been here so long that she began chickening out." As I pondered the twisted logic of his words, my nostrils were suddenly assaulted by a vile and noxious odor, a searing graveyard stench. It was more than I could stand. But fortunately, they were putting my mother back now, and as I turned to leave hastily, sickened to my very soul, the man handed me back a few of my coins and said once again, "I'm sorry, son, but there was simply nothing we could do when she started to chicken out." "That's all right," I told him, wanting to throw up. "It's not really your fault. I mean, I guess this must be what I came for." And so I took my leave in a kind of half panic, thrusting the change into my pocket and running for the door. I must have passed hundreds of people who were here for the same purpose. But as I raced through the crowd, past the huge pillars, down the thousand marble steps, heading for the causeway, I couldn't help wondering about the actual purpose of the dreadful rites of Necrosha. And as I ran pell-mell back to the dormitory, there to await my friends, the Somber Brothers, I also couldn't help wondering what I should do with the rest of the money. The following is from the same book, Nightmares for the Yesterday People and Other Illustrated Stories, also read by Goblin Hood. Dream Wars, a loosely knit trilogy of horribly true stories involving the politics of psychosis and depicting an epic campaign waged against the divided self. The Dream Quest of Mr. Christian's Dilemma. Part 1. The Wedding. I dreamed I was at a friend's wedding. The strangest aspect of this weird nightmare was its detailed and consistent accuracy. The groom was somebody real whom I recognized, a friend of mine from my waking existence in the real world. The wedding took place in a real house, which actually exists on 15th Avenue in Columbus, Ohio, a renovated former fraternity house, which I actually visited awake one night, years ago in my real world persona, and where, back in real life, I actually saw a reproduction of Dali's famous disappearing bust of Voltaire for the very first time. Anyway, in my dream, I was attending a wedding and reception in this house and wearing my General Idea jacket, a purplish, hand-painted, quasi-military sport coat, which I actually did paint back in 1975 and which I've been wearing around the streets of Columbus ever since. In my dream, I was mostly just eating and drinking and talking with the groom, when I suddenly realized something rather peculiar. I hadn't yet seen the bride. In fact, I didn't even know who my friend had married or where she was. That made me wonder, and when I asked the groom, he laughed and said, "Oh, she's in here." he then led me into the next room where his new wife was reclining on a bed, dressed all in white. The first thing I noticed about her was that she was dead, had been, in fact, dead for quite some time. I still didn't know who she was. I didn't know just what to say either, and felt strongly that things were getting more and more peculiar by the minute. But my chief impression was one of grave and impending social embarrassment. I didn't know what I should do next. I knew that a wedding guest normally kisses the bride, but somehow I didn't really feel as if this situation was truly covered by that time-honored tradition. Hell, I didn't even know who the bride had been. Yet I had no wish to offend my friend by not kissing his dead wife, and so in the end I soon found myself actually pressing my lips against her cold and clammy jaws, and as I did so, the dream suddenly changed somehow. I don't know if I can even explain it. There was a current or something, a rush of bizarre energy as palpable as electrical voltage, surging and warping throughout the entire fabric of the dream. And as I drew away from the cadaverous bride, I noticed that everyone was now looking at me very queerly, almost apprehensively. The wedding guests all seemed to have grown exceedingly nervous all of a sudden, and none more so than myself, because I was beginning to wonder if kissing such a dead bride had been a disastrous faux pas. But then somebody nervously piped up, "Hey, let's all go out for a drink." And thus it was decided that we should all retire to a nearby tavern and continue the party there. But just as we were leaving, a caterer walked up to the groom's father, who was paying for everything, and handed him a bill, listing all the food and drinks which had been consumed at the reception. Then he handed the father another bill, which was essentially a body count, and which listed the names of all the people who had died because of the wedding. Part 2. Mr. Christian's Revisited. And so, in my dream, we were soon on our way to a local bar for some liquid refreshment. There used to be a place back in real life on High Street near the Ohio State University campus called Mr. Christian's Dilemma, a bar which I often used to frequent years before I had this dream, back when I first came to Columbus as an art student at the university. The bar itself is still there, but has changed hands and names several times since those halcyon student days of yesteryear. Anyway, I dreamed it was still Mr. Christian's and that our wedding party was journeying there in quest of a drink, pulling the bride corpse along behind us in a little red wagon, since she was too dead to walk. When we arrived at the bar, we all sat around a big table, eating popcorn and drinking big pitchers of dark beer. Back in reality, Mr. Christian's had had one of the better jukeboxes around, and in my dream I remembered this and decided to go play some music. I don't have the slightest idea what tunes I selected when I got to the jukebox, and I guess it really doesn't matter very much anyway, because when I dropped the coins into the slot, the machine began playing some of the weirdest, eeriest, creepiest music that I had ever heard at the time or have ever heard since. Gloomy and foreboding, hellishly pounding with subsonic menace, incorporating hideous and spine-chilling tones and notes produced by unidentifiable instruments and with a horribly ghoulish and maniacal yet hauntingly familiar nightmare chorus of unintelligible demonic chanting. The music was unlike anything I've ever experienced, both in its sound and in its effect. Because as I stood there, listening helplessly, I found that I was frozen with fear, literally paralyzed with fright and dread of the music. In fact, looking around, I realized that everyone in the entire bar had been similarly paralyzed by the music that I had played. At first, I was at a complete loss to identify this terrible opus until years later, in real life, when I composed it myself, a sardonic and ghastly tune entitled War Chants. But at the time, in my dream, I hadn't started writing music yet, and I didn't particularly care who had written this. I was simply glad and relieved when it ended, so that we could all move around again. Later, as we were leaving the bar, a waiter walked up to us and handed the groom a bill, listing all of the food and drinks consumed by the wedding party. Then the waiter turned and handed me a bill as well, a body count, really, which listed the names of all the people who had died because of the music. Dream warfare. I once dreamed that I was a desperate guerrilla freedom fighter living in a jungle somewhere. Part of the dream's plot seemed to have been stolen from a Hemingway novel. I think we were trying to blow up a train or a bridge or something. Whatever our mission was, we had pinned all our hopes and dreams on it, and seemed to be regarding it as a matter of the utmost importance and extreme urgency. I believe that we were fairly successful in our enterprise, though I can't be quite certain. Anyway, I later found myself with my family, my children and their mother, and we, with our friends and neighbors, were all trying to escape from a tiny, doomed jungle hamlet. Our enemies were using flamethrowers, machine guns, tanks, and jelly gasoline, with an occasional neutron bomb thrown in for good measure. Whilst my companions and I had to fight using squirt guns, pop guns, and common household objects such as knives, forks, spoons, and spatulas, our enemies were pursuing us on horses and motorcycles, with helicopters strafing us overhead, whilst my comrades and I were fleeing desperately to the next supposedly safe village on tricycles, pogo sticks, and our own 2 feet, and sometimes even on our hands and knees, crawling for dear life. We were having a hell of a time. I don't know what brand of cruel dream logic it was that ever made me believe that we had any kind of a chance at all in our mad, gruesome exodus through that eerie dream jungle away from the terrifying weaponry. But I was actually beginning to hope that we'd almost made it when suddenly, without any warning, on the outskirts of the next village, I and the other survivors found ourselves totally surrounded by tanks, horses, and motorcycles with machine guns in our faces and helicopters hovering around directly overhead. And suddenly, my companions were all dead, and I was alone with my merciless foes. And suddenly, in a flash, the trees were all gone and the napalm was thicker than hell-flavored jello. And suddenly, standing there amid the carnage and slaughter, knee-deep in gore and holding an egg beater and a broken ping-pong paddle, I realized that I was being chased bloodily out of my own dream by the awesome technology of my adversaries, and I suddenly found myself laughing and crying hysterically, convulsively, as the staccato burst from an enemy machine gun suddenly tore me apart. Dragon Copter. Have you ever had one of those bizarre dreams in which you couldn't wake up because you couldn't even be sure that you were really dreaming? I once found myself in such a predicament, and I can tell you it was a near thing. I sometimes believe that if my subconscious had not taken drastic steps on that occasion to get me out of bed and back on my feet, I would be there still. It happened years ago, during the late afternoon of a cold and rainy Thursday, late in the fall of 1975. I was lying fully clothed on my bed, drowsing away in the moody twilight of my gloaming bedroom, wondering if I should get up and go into my combination studio and living room to work on the new painting that I had going, which was entitled Bedlam. I didn't want to fall asleep because I was expecting company that evening. So I was just lying around there, and I remember it was very chilly because the corner of my bedroom window had a large gaping hole cracked out of the glass that I could never get my landlady to repair. Occasionally, my two cats would drag dead birds and things into the house through this hole. Anyway, I must have dozed off because I remember waking up with a start and realizing that I was listening to the radio in the living room, but that I had neither turned it on nor left it on. So I was wondering just how the thing had gotten on when I turned and looked toward the sound and received a shock. It wasn't the radio at all. It was a television set. But I didn't have a television set. And as I realized this, I saw the imagery, the imaginary TV, fade away almost furtively and metamorphosize itself back into the dresser that was normally sitting beside my bed. But now I no longer had any way to tell if I was still dreaming or not. I seemed to be awake, and my eyes were certainly open, but the room was too dark to see very well, and I was unable to move to get out of bed. And then I heard the TV again, and when I looked, I saw that it was back. I seemed to be watching a news broadcast of some sort, where two rather querulous announcers were telling each other about what sounded like a nuclear disaster in Cleveland, Ohio. I remember one of them saying that Cleveland had been violted, which sounded to me like a cross between electricity and atomic combustion or something. And I began to panic, lying there, thinking that the world was ending and that the same thing might be about to happen to Columbus. Suddenly, I was possessed by an overwhelming urge to get up and go out and see some friends for the last time and warn them about Columbus maybe getting violted, when I noticed that the news announcers had now changed their tune. They seemed to be glancing furtively at me, as if they were aware of my distress and afraid of further alarming me. And now they began reassuring each other that all that had really happened was that lightning had struck the terminal tower in Cleveland, making all of the lights go out. So it wasn't really a very serious emergency after all. And then I remembered again that I didn't have a television set and concluded that I must still be dreaming. At this point, I was determined to wake up and go in the other room and work on my painting. I turned to the TV, but now it was gone again and had been replaced, this time, by a large canvas leaning against the dresser on which was a half-finished painting that I had apparently started a long time ago and never finished. Only I had never seen this painting before. It depicted a massive thermonuclear holocaust, and in the center of the carnage was a large grinning figure of a man standing behind a table. He had my face and was wearing a spattered butcher's apron over some sort of weird, vaguely papal-looking jeweled armor made of precious metals and culminating in a helmet or a crown with a cross on top. With a meat cleaver, he was chopping up human bodies. Shocked by this grisly tableau, I realized that I was dreaming again and became desperate, wondering, as I stared wildly about the darkening room, if I would ever wake up at all. Suddenly there was a knock on my back door, which was connected to the bedroom. Thinking that this must surely be the visitors I'd been expecting, I leaped out of bed to answer the knock and found instead that it was some other friends and associates of mine who had brought a stranger along to look at my paintings. A not uncommon occurrence. But I was overjoyed just to be really awake at last. And soon we were all sitting around my living room, drinking coffee and smoking dope. My friends had brought over some good hash, and I was well on my way to getting completely ripped when suddenly there was another loud knock on my front door this time, and when I got up and opened it, there was my little gray cat, Frumper, who had apparently been outside all afternoon. Something, however, was wrong. At first I thought it was simply the hash, but no, there was definitely something wrong with my cat, who seemed to be made out of butter or cheese, because as she stretched and yawned in front of me, she suddenly began oozing and slithering across the floor like taffy, and I became aware that I was back in bed again, still dreaming, and I opened my eyes and saw that it was almost evening. And as I stared at the impending darkness through my window, I gradually began to notice an eerie, persistent, droning sound. A tiny, hellishly obnoxious buzzing on the edge of my consciousness. And then I saw it. This thing flew into my bedroom through the broken window. A hideous, insectoid creature that swooped, buzzing fiendishly in great orbits around my bed. In the darkness, I could only glimpse it vaguely, but it seemed to be a cross between a dragonfly and a tiny police helicopter. It looked viciously evil and extremely dangerous. And just as I was wondering what kind of a sting it would have, I saw it come in for a landing on the bed, only inches from my face. And then, oh Christ, I could actually feel it somehow. A subtle vibration transmitted through linen as the ghastly little monstrosity began creeping and crawling ominously towards me. And then I was up and running, dashing pell-mell into the living room with a wild shriek. And the shock of it must have done the trick, because I woke up in a cold sweat, standing in my living room, shaking like a leaf. And you can't imagine my intense relief to discover that I was really and truly awake this time. But it was fully an hour before I could force myself to venture back into the bedroom, even to turn the light on and assure myself that the dragon copter was gone. Yeah, well, this here's a little note from Goblin Hood. Just to say that it's interesting because it's interesting that the only date I can give for any of these dreams is sometime previous to 1981. I know they were all around in one written form or another for at least a year before that, because I was working on this book for a couple of years before it finally got published. Or rather, Beatty was, of course. Speaking of Beatty, his so-called music writing never really got off the ground, although that here from Goblin Hood. Just to say that, to complete the sentence I started on the other side, the song War Chants, or whatever you would call it, the piece War Chants, along with the music for it, is actually printed here in this book, Nightmares for the Yesterday People and Other Illustrated Stories, copyright 1981 by James Beatty. And now I'm going to finally go ahead and read the title story of that, since it should just about fit on the amount of tape I've got left here. Nightmares for the Yesterday People by James Beatty, read by Goblin Hood. Part 1. I have read, I forget just where, that the human body completely regenerates itself once every several years. Imagine that. I have also read, again, the exact source eludes me, that not even the humblest micromolecule escapes changing irrevocably from microsecond to microsecond. Either one of these assertions would be enough, if true, to fully substantiate Shelley's claim that nothing is immutable except for mutability. Both statements together seem almost to indicate that events are transpiring around us almost faster than said events can actually occur, or something of the sort. As Fuller might have put it, the universe itself is a verb. At any rate, I've read these things, and somehow it comforts me to know that perpetual change is almost a cosmic law in view of our ghastly situation. In fact, it is wise to take comfort and solace wherever they can be found. Today I am alive, a living, breathing organism calling itself I is writing this story with a ballpoint pen, but I will never type it. Yet it will be typed, and by a being very similar to me calling itself I, probably only a few days hence. But by that time, I will no longer be around. A paradox. Though I speak only slightly in riddles, yet can I hear most of you, most of my readers, crying, "Why all the mystery? Explain all this. Better to start again." I have made a discovery. I am public. publishing my findings. A commendable enough undertaking, you might say. Yet consider this. My discovery, though probably of vast import, can be of no possible benefit or positive use to the human race. Indeed, it can only function to further traumatize my already psychotic society, possibly even helping to bring about the final, terminal desperation of the human spirit. A better man would keep the knowledge to himself. Then why publish, you ask? Call it a weakness of the condemned prisoner, a death row caprice. Alone, with no moral support, I am dying of this knowledge, and the horror of the situation is reflected in the fact that if I can, I am perfectly willing to take you all with me. And this is, after all, a horror story. Speaking of psychosis, as I was briefly in the last paragraph, it seems highly possible that my important discovery could only have been made by a paranoid schizophrenic such as myself. I'm not talking about that thin line between genius and insanity. Rather, I refer to the very nature of my discovery, which would probably never have occurred to a more stable mind. Such are the dubious benefits of mental illness. You are waiting, no doubt, for me to state my thesis and get it over with. Are you really that anxious to see the stable and secure universe of your own imagining collapse around you? Have patience, I beg you. I will get to the point, but a truth such as mine must be led up to gradually and carefully, lest it shatter the unprepared mind. I assure you, my truth can be lived with. We've been doing it all along. But my news is much graver than you might suppose. Certainly a much more shocking revelation than one might expect to find in the average horror story. But almost all truth turns out to be a horror story in the end. Like many profound but oft unpleasant truths, my discovery can probably best be expressed in the form of a parable. Like many another good parable, my offering will require a certain amount of background. After all, what meaning could the tale of the Good Samaritan convey to one who was ignorant of Samaria? But fortunately, my story can get by with only a minimal amount of briefing. In effect, it is sufficient to say that I once was happily married to a woman whom I loved very much. Though we've long since separated, we still see each other and remain good friends. But the important fact here is that we no longer sleep together. I sleep alone now. Anyway, back when we were sleeping with each other, I developed a very weird habit in answer to a phenomenon which had been plaguing me for most of my life, a habit which was based upon the luxury of having another person regularly in bed with me. To be brief, at last, the habit was simply this. On many occasions, and with ever-increasing success as my technique improved, I was able to escape from a particularly bad nightmare by loudly screaming in my sleep until my wife was obliged to wake me up. Perhaps there's nothing quite so unusual about this, and certainly nightmares were nothing new to me at the time. I've always been prone to them, yet still I am fascinated by the quickness and cleverness with which my subconscious dreaming mind began exploiting and utilizing the fact that there was another person in bed with me. Somehow, the reassuring presence of my wife seemed to register even in my dream state, and my mind realized that by screaming aloud, as opposed to merely screaming within the dream, I could quickly gain access to the waking world, and thus my cunning subconscious mind developed a sort of an automatic fail-safe system for escaping from my worst dreams, at least until my wife and I split up. After that, I can only recall waking up that way once when I was by myself, and I hope it will never happen again. I shudder to remember it. The dreams, by the way, had nothing to do with my wife, although they might seem to upon casual examination. But in one variation or another, they have been with me all my life. And so, though they came more frequently after my marriage, one mustn't seek to blame their increase upon the presence of my wife in bed. Rather, it was the deliberate escapes from these horrid fantasies which I had learned subconsciously to effect with the somewhat reluctant help of my wife, which was probably to blame for the escalated frequency of the nightmares. I suppose, deep within my mind, some part of me rather enjoyed having the dreams, once I knew that I could get out of them so easily. If all the world were as tormented in sleep as I, this system for escaping from nightmares would be, in itself, reason enough for people to sleep together. But now I must describe the actual dreams, and here I fear I will probably disappoint you. They are really nothing so remarkable. Yet the vividness of these fantasies, their hideous, damnable realism, this element alone was what caused me to seek an exit from them. And wisely, for when I was finally trapped in one of these awful nightmares with no hope for escape, I learned the single most devastating truth in my life, a truth which has utterly drained me of peace and left me a shattered hulk for whom there can be no peace, not in bed, not even in the grave. The dreams would always start innocuously enough with images so devoid of import that I usually failed even to remember them. Or perhaps the mind-blasting shock of the dream's climax was enough to blot out what had gone before, and the climax was always the same. I would realize that I was in bed dreaming, and that someone or something was nearby, something hideous and malignant, something that was torturing my mind, torturing my very dream. Sometimes the thing was in bed with me, although it was not my wife. Sometimes it would be lurking in a nearby closet, and I could feel its ghastly fingers or its tendrils probing in my brain through the back of my head. Once I even became convinced that it was directly above me upon the roof. It always seemed extremely real and in close proximity to me, and I was always gripped with an intense need to escape the dream realm before the thing could use its terrifying powers upon me. Although I actually had only a vague idea as to what those powers might be. And when, as I would begin hoarsely screaming and shouting for help, my wife would wake me up with her own sleep shattered, there was always a lingering hint of menace, as though the bizarre creature had half followed me into this world and was still waiting for me on the other side of sleep. Oddly though, when I returned to sleep, the creature was never then around. Possibly it was scared off by the presence of my wife, or perhaps to dream of it once in a night was enough to establish a kind of immunity to it. I only saw the thing once with enough clarity to remember or describe it, but that once was enough to butcher my sleep for the rest of my days. For I saw it in bed with me, saw it clearly because I had left the light on one night when I was sleeping alone. And as I woke up screaming with no person there to drive away my fears, I turned and glimpsed the thing lying there, grinning horribly at me in the light, feasting on my terror. And when I saw the thing on this occasion, my eyes were wide open, and I was more than half awake. And this hideous, spine-chilling nightmare vision was the key to my understanding of the phenomenon, and also provided the basis for the description of the thing in the narrative which follows. And yes, this background information is coming to an end, and I am finally about to relate the parable which contains my great secret, a simple dream description, for all dreams are parables of a sort. As I write this, at the end of an exhausting night, the clock strikes 6 a.m., and I know that my body cannot hold out much longer. Would that I had some amphetamines to keep me awake, for soon I must sleep, and I am afraid. I fear that writing of the thing will invoke it, for such is the power of suggestion, in which case it waits for me, even now, in my bed across the room. Yet I had to write this to let people know what I have learned about the nature of human experience, being pretty sure that if I didn't write this, nobody else would, since most of you are still asleep. And I also knew, due to the nature of my discovery, that if I didn't do it now, before sleep overtook me, I would never get the chance. For tomorrow, I won't be here. And so I offer you the following report on my findings, a schizophrenic parable made up of a number of isolated dream fragments strung together in a simulated sequence and culminating in the big one, the one to end all sleep, the one to set you free. Doubtless, I will have this dream tonight. Part 2. Am cold, brittle, and fuzzy, no light here. Where am I? The jester took off his mask to reveal a face of shining darkness and laughter. Too miserable to see, I could only hear the light, but I could sense the coming of a big change. And we were flying. A plane was soaring, burning across the sky, and we were all sitting in pews, worshiping the pilot. But the plane dived down, and I was left standing in a cage, or a jail cell, or a hospital. Two women lay upon a mattress in the corner, but the entire floor was a mattress. Around us was a latticework of grilled bars. I approached the corner and began pleading with one of the women. The other was on my side. "Please, we have to get out of here," I said, but I couldn't remember why. She must have realized this. "Give me even one good reason," she replied with a smirk. And I looked up over my shoulder and beheld another cage, suspended in midair, about halfway up one of our walls, and in this smaller cage within our cage was a young lamb, which backed up to the bars of its cage and pressed its hind quarters against the grill work and began pissing upon the mattress, which was our floor. "There," I cried triumphantly, "do you really need any more reason than this?" Suddenly, the cell was gone, and I was alone again, but not quite alone. There was something hideous and grisly, mocking me, hating me, waiting for me just around the corner of my mind. And thus, seeking to avoid it, I traveled far and wide in the vacuous dreamscapes of the silent world. There were endless nighted mountains to climb, and vast Stygian deserts to cross, and shadowy, bottomless valleys of gloaming mystery. A thousand cities of gleaming spires did I dwell in for a thousand million dream years. But always did I come back to the same place, an upstairs room, bleak and cheerless, within which a rainstorm was seething, a room where teeth would crumble and hundreds of identical babies would squall in the rain like crackles, a room where tiny skeletons with canes and straw hats would tap dance burning across my mind, and icy tendrils of soul-sickening fear and horror would lure me hellishly toward the forbidden door. And then I was at a wedding, and then I was at a trial, and then I was at a funeral where there were no locks upon the doors. The pallbearers were dressed as women in mourning, but they all had heavy beards. And then I was in an alley, just off of a darkened city street. A huge, dark, and shadowy man, recognizable as a feared and abhorred uncle from my childhood, was snarling viciously at me and beating upon me with his fists. And I was in tears, falling again and again with my face in the gravel below me, but always getting back up to be knocked down once more. And as the man slammed his fists into me, I kept trying to say, "I'm sorry, I'm really sorry," but I found that I couldn't speak at all. "What's wrong with you, goddammit?" he bellowed, smashing a ham-like fist into my jaw. "Do you want to go back to the jail cell again? So, you think you will ride in airplanes? And how long do you think I've been following you, eh? And how many mountains and deserts and valleys and cities do you think I've had to go through to catch up with you, eh? I'm wise to your conniving little tricks, boy. Don't you worry about that. You think you will dream of airplanes. You even think you will go through the forbidden door. Please, I'm really sorry," I tried to say as he knocked me down again. But then he was gone, and I found myself at a party, a large masquerade. 100 people that I knew were there, and a festive time was being had by all. Somebody was playing music, a popular recording of skeletons dancing, and I could hear the harsh, grating sound of babies crying outside. A breathtakingly familiar woman suddenly screamed that there was a spider on the wall. And I looked, and it was true. Oh God, a huge black and hairy tarantula was walking across a nearby wall, and I ran to it, absolutely horrified of spiders, and I beat it to death with a large waste basket. And somebody quietly slipped its mangled carcass into the waste basket. And then they all gathered around me and praised and congratulated me, pounding me upon the back, for I was a champion and a spider-slaying hero. But the woman suddenly cried, "It's not really dead!" And picking the writhing trash can up, she hurled its loathsome contents into my face, and I saw the spider flying at me, its hideous black jaws yawning to engulf me. But the dream changed again without warning, and the next thing I knew was that I was standing naked on a windy city street at what appeared to be high noon, standing next to the wall of a building. In front of me on the wall was a large poster or a painting of a strange and disturbing surrealist landscape. In the foreground was what appeared to be a massive nuclear explosion, a fierce mushroom cloud of stupendous proportions, but at the same time, it also looked like a giant city. In the picture's background were other explosions, which were also virtually indistinguishable from cities. In my confusion, I fancied that they all looked like popcorn. The predominant colors were purple and yellow, and of course I was confounded by all this, but at least I had momentarily forgotten all about the spider, the uncle, and the forbidden door. Just then, two women walked by, one of whom had the face of a favorite cat that I had once lived with back in the waking world. She stopped and spoke to me, saying, "Do you remember that time you were imprisoned in that hospital? You volunteered for that, you know." Of course, I had no answer for this, and in fact, could not even remember the incident in question. But as she hurried away, I suddenly realized that it was highly urgent that I follow her and her companion. I ran as fast as I could, but I could not catch up with them, though they were merely walking at a slow pace. Presently, we came to a bridge that I remembered from my youth. I had grown up on a small farm in rural Ohio, and this bridge was just up a hill from my house. In my dimly remembered past, it had been a trestle bridge over railroad tracks, but now it spanned a dark and madly flowing river. The two cat women strolled casually over the bridge to a mystical, enchanted land of powerful and compelling attraction. But I was unable to follow, because in my youth, I had always been afraid of this gloomy and foreboding bridge, and now I feared it still. Presently, as I hung back, trying to summon up the courage needed for the dread passage, my fear was wholly substantiated and justified as I watched a passing car attempt to cross the bridge and instead go veering crazily through the guardrail to plunge horribly into the dark river on my side of the bridge. I knew that I could never make that bold crossing, not even if my dream should last a million aeons or more. But then, with only the slightest sensation of transition or movement, I was back in the rainy upstairs room, holding an album of tiny skeleton recordings and watching a golden ring crumble upon my very finger. Three babies with identical Aladdin-sane haircuts were squawking at a winged gorilla, looking just like so many baby birds crying for a worm. And I said to the ape, why don't you give them a shot of heroin? But the beast just grinned at me and pointed at the forbidden door through the rain, saying, why don't you go through there? The only other way out of this room leads to the grim, dark alley of the uncle, a place where I'm sure you don't want to go. And I nodded cautiously and approached the frightful portal, and as I did so, I noticed that it bore a carven death's head and a small plaque upon which were the words, beware the eater of yesterdays. And I walked through the forbidden door to a gloomy, nebulous place which was very near the waking world, and there I beheld the awful truth. A man was lying on a bed, sleeping in a bedroom where the light was still on, and there was something gruesomely lying next to him in bed and doing something unspeakable to the back of the man's head. This man, whom I now saw, bore my own face. My throat became dry and tight, and I found myself fighting down a wave of nausea as I recognized the other thing, a ghastly apparition from my youth, a thing that had haunted my dreams for as long as I could remember. And now I saw clearly, for the very first time, that this hideous, ghoulish creature also had my own face, yet in spectral caricature, a gaunt and rotten travesty of my face with moldering bones and teeth showing through the putrid skin, a leering greenish-yellow death's head with only the vaguest remnants of a face, my face, and with a matching body, as skeletal and emaciated as the thing's horrid countenance. And I saw now how the loathsome monster was repulsively engaged, as it gnashed and gibbered at me in a shrill and unclean voice, spinning, grinning horribly all the while. I saw that it was somehow feeding upon my hapless, sleeping doppelganger, scraping nameless things out of the victim's violated skull and putting them between its own fiendish jaws. And then I remembered the warning upon the forbidden door, and it came to me just what the thing was and what it was doing, that this creature was my own death, not sometime in the distant future, but right now and always, as I die, minute by minute, day by day. It was the fabled eater of yesterdays, and it was eating my past, devouring all my experiences right up to the present, changing them, twisting them from pieces of solid reality into dim playthings of memory. The presence of this despicable harbinger of perpetual death had destroyed any lingering resemblance to the real world, and now it was nullifying my very existence with its ghoulish, vampiric lust, and I was disgusted past all endurance by this outrageous murder of time itself, and I began to pray and wish with a mad fervor that the poor fool on the bed would wake up and escape for an all too brief while the dreadful and omnipresent curse of death. And then he did wake up, screaming loudly and sitting bolt upright in the bed with a wild look in his eyes. And as the tomorrow man leaped screaming out of bed and dashed terror-stricken from the room, the fiendish, ghastly eater of yesterdays, that damned, drooling
feaster of forgotten souls, turned its slobbering nightmare jaws toward me. And I began to scream and scream for the rest of the universe.
This is a little postscript from Goblin Hood, because the title story from the Nightmares for the Yesterday People book sort of deserves its own side of tape to itself. I'm currently working on trying to publish another little book, hopefully, possibly through the Free Press, hopefully in time for the next ComFest, based on an 82-page typescript that's called Libby's Monument. This was written and typed less than a year ago, right now, about 7 or 8 months, in fact. And one of the interesting things about it is that it resurrects the whole Yesterday People conundrum, or whatever you call it. And in a section of that book that's pretty much narrated by Goblin Hood, that is to say by me, as opposed to Beatty, who gets to narrate most of it, I talk about the story, I kind of take it apart, and I'm sort of like, you know, speaking in the second or third or whatever person here. Goblin Hood is sort of like making fun of Beatty's story, and particularly making fun of his writing abilities, which isn't too hard to do. I mean, that is a florid story, and like when you start talking about micromolecules and so forth, it's pretty ridiculous. Beatty had no idea what he was talking about. He didn't even know what a molecule was. But at the same time, reading this now, I expected it to be kind of turgid and absurd, and yet I got caught up in it. It's not half bad as a horror story, possibly just because I know that it happens to be a true story, that there's something about what I'm talking about that's absolutely true. In Libby's Monument, Goblin Hood speculates as to what Beatty's trying to do, because Libby's Monument is one of the most uplifting, or would be uplifting, things that Beatty's ever written. And reading this now, it's interesting to me that at the end of the first section, there's a little thing. You know how it says, tomorrow I won't be here. And then after that, it kind of like breaks the tension to say, so I'm offering you this report, etc. Full of isolated dream fragments strung together in a simulated sequence, and culminating in the big one, the one to end all sleep, the one to set you free. Doubtless I will have this dream tonight, blah blah. Okay, I once had a good friend who was a professional writer, who looked at the story and said he liked it, or, you know, at least he liked the first part, but he didn't like that last paragraph. He thought that should have been left out. And obviously I didn't agree, because here it is in the published version of the story. But reading it now, I suddenly know why I don't agree. First of all, there's a specific thing where it says that, you know, I'm probably going to have this dream tonight. It refers back to the part where it talks about invoking something, and how talking about the thing might invoke it. So clearly I was afraid that if I wrote all this stuff down, I would actually go ahead and have that very simulated dream. But more than that is the phrase, the one to make you free, the one to set you free. Based on the old saying, seek ye the truth, and the truth will set you free. I guess that's from the Bible. And I guess that's what Libby's monument was trying to do in dredging this back up. Because it's not written that time as a horror story. It's written almost as a sort of a comedy. An apocalyptic comedy. And yet, reflecting on it now, I realize that even the Beatty of 1981, with his, you know, putrid little horror story, was trying to free people from something. He was trying to free people from how seriously they take life and how frightened they are of death. He was trying to remind them that, look, you know, apart from the pain and like that, it's something we go through every day. You know, if you think your consciousness survives intact, you know, between one waking period and another, you're only kidding yourself. It's like, just ask these people in the dream what they think as they get snuffed out. You know, they're only there momentarily, but the thing is, they're like lucky to be there at all. I mean, this is the only existence that they have. And so, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is that reading this now, reading the original Nightmares for the Yesterday People horror story, I begin to understand what Beatty is doing, why he wants to, like, bring it back up and reiterate it and try again to affect the final desperation of the human spirit or whatever it is he's doing. Because Beatty somehow really believes in this. And because even if it only functions to further traumatize his already psychotic society, possibly even helping to bring about the final terminal desperation of the human spirit and so on. The fact is, you can't learn anything without that kind of trauma. You know, to accept the new, you have to give up the old. And I guess Beatty wants to believe there's some sort of a new world on the other side of this story, where if we could face what we are and stop pretending so hard that each of us lives for, you know, close to 100 years, where in fact we barely make it through the day, maybe it would change the way we live. Maybe it would change the way we see ourselves. Maybe it would even change the way we see each other. Of course, Nightmares for the Yesterday People never changed anything. And Libby's monument, assuming it gets published, it's not going to change anything either. So, you know, lots of Ruck, Beatty, and Goblin Hood, and, you know, the whole Mary clan, but you can't say they didn't try. I guess that's what it's all about, is trying. Is attempting to make what you can out of what you've got. What Beatty has is this little thesis that he's, like, come up with and that he's lived with for years. Not just since 1981, but since the events of the dream, because every one of the little scenes in this dream story was based on a dream that Beatty actually had, and none more so than that last kind of apocalyptic situation there. That really happened. Well, it all really happened. And it's all happening all the time. It's an awareness that from the moment you're born, actually even before that, you're already dying. You're always dying. And Beati isn't trying to rub this in people's faces. What he's doing is trying to help them come to terms with it. Because when you think about it, I mean, it actually gets boring. Okay, another day, another death. You know, it might not be fun for people to have to go to bed each night knowing that they personally will never see the sunrise. But on the other hand, you know, if you did that every day, then you wouldn't have to worry so much about finally doing it at the very end, because you'd realize that it just doesn't mean anything, you know? And like, heaven and hell, well, they don't come into this necessarily, but why should they be any different from any other dream state? And we know so little about the dream state. We know so little about what's actually happening while we're asleep. Or at least I know so little about. But I once wrote a thing called The Expert Dreamer, and I meant it, because I've spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff. So, for this tape, this is the second tape of Steel Bob and Monstrella, which was itself a dream story, which partly wound up being about death. It's fitting that two of the stories in the Nightmares book happened to be about the artist's departed mother, because so was parts of Steel Bob and Monstrella. And now, one thing I can say, I don't like to go to bed anymore, but I'm not afraid to dream anymore, because I realize that it represents more life, not less, that the dreams we remember are an extra helping of existence, and that those people we become when we're asleep, without that, they would never get to exist at all. So yeah, the dream persona in the Nightmares story may be yelping there at the end. And don't expect me to refrain from yelping when I finally come to my end. And as for Goblinhood, why, Goblinhood will probably yelp the loudest of anybody there is, just because somehow I don't think the poor beggar ever really expected to end. Better step out of character for a minute to say that, but now this would be Goblinhood again talking.